has the whole world gone crazy? Am I the only one around here who gives a shit about the rules? Market Zero!
They're calling the cops, man. Put the piece away.
Market Zero!
Walter, put the piece away.
Walter?
You think I'm fucking around here, Market Zero?
Welcome to the Quest Below.
Shut up. Welcome to the bonus episode of Cinema Crespo. So I'm your host, Chris Crespo, hanging out with Joseph Cogburn, Drew.
What up?
Trying to start my own damn show. This guy won't shut up for once. We are doing a Crespo film school. In case you couldn't tell by the title, thank you for blindly downloading whatever you put out there. We appreciate it. Let's tell you what you're listening to.
Oh, man, we should totally fuck with him once. Label it one thing and give it something completely different.
Minutes of cat noises.
If they're just blindly downloading.
If you're just blindly downloading without reading the titles, again, thank you. We really appreciate that. You are the best in the world. Thank you. But this is the Crespo Film School bonus episode. We are talking about the Coen brothers, the Coens, Joel and Ethan Coen from suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota, somewhere up there in the cold, frigid north.
Brr.
Maybe people wonder why their movies can be so cold.
It's because they are.
It's because they have it in them. And they still live in New York City. They just got snowed on. Anyway, Coen brothers, love them. They've done a whole bunch of movies as writers, directors, and producers, often writing, directing, and producing their own films. Very rarely do other people get involved in some of those processes. Well, there's always tons of producers, but writing and directing, it's their thing. It's what they do. They're known as the two-headed beast, the Coens, because if you're working on a movie with them, right, and you have a question about anything, you can ask either one. Doesn't matter which one you ask.
Nice.
About anything. No matter which one you ask, you'll get the same answer because they're that much in sync.
Wow.
With how they want to make their movies.
That's still crazy.
It is a little crazy, right?
Almost a little scary.
Only a 3-year age difference between them. They are now 60 and 57 years old. I think Joel's the oldest.
Goddamn.
Yeah, yeah. Age. It gets to you like that. And they've been making movies together since they were kids. You know, it's one of those things. The older one, again, I think it's Joel. The older one he saved up his money, got a Super 8 camera, and then they started remaking movies and things that they saw on TV.
Okay.
And then college came around. Joel went to NYU Film School, same place Spike Lee went to. Spike Lee and Oliver Stone, you know, they go there and teach there every now and then. Mm-hmm. It's that type of place, right? And younger brother Ethan ended up at, where did he go? He went to Princeton, right there in Jersey.
Okay.
And not doing film. He did something else.
I was about to say, I don't think Princeton has reputable film program.
Not at the Princeton Film School. No, no. He was doing something else. But then, you know, they started working together immediately after school. Early 80s, Joel Ethan got a job as an assistant editor on a little movie called The Evil Dead.
Okay.
And that's where he met Sam Raimi.
Nice.
Sam, Joel, and Ethan worked together on a number of projects in the 80s. That came to fruition over time. So Sam helped them out with their first movie, Blood Simple, which we'll talk about here in a minute. And at the same time, Joe and Ethan helped co-write Sam Raimi's movie from 84, Crime Wave, 84, 85. Also, around that same time, they co-wrote, which movie? They co-wrote The Hudsucker Proxy. The three of them in the 80s. That didn't get made until the 90s. One of those things. Yeah. They wrote it back in the day. Then it came around, hey, we can actually get this made now. So we'll talk about that when we get to it. We'll start at the beginning. We're going to go through all the films of the Coen brothers. We're starting with Blood Simple from 1984. You remember this one, Drew?
Yes.
You remember?
Would you like me to read the synopsis?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let people know. What's the IMDb synopsis?
Yes.
Yeah, how do they sum up this movie?
All right. A rich but jealous man hires a private investigator to kill his cheating wife and her new man.
Mm-hmm.
But when blood is involved, nothing is simple.
Ayo! Hoo-ah! That's cute.
It's got the Mehmet, bro. That's all. That's what I remember. Mehmet in a cowboy hat.
Mehmet Walsh. M. Emmett Walsh. He's amazing as the the hitman. It's more like a private investigator that does hitman stuff on the side.
He's so old.
He's already old in that movie. He's old now. He was old then.
He's so old then. He's still super old.
But he was still, like, and it's funny, too, because he's, we'll just call it as it is. He's kind of an ugly dude.
Oh, yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah.
He's not your typical movie guy, because he's more like a character actor, mm-hmm. right? He's got a lot of character in his face.
Oh, yeah.
He's a shorter dude, stocky.
Yeah, he could totally be the weird old guy in any number of movies.
And as you said, he's old. He keeps saying he's old, which he is. He was ancient at that time. He still is. But by the end of that movie, he's still such a badass. It's like, this guy is a badass. Yeah. I mean, he's like punching holes through walls, and he's getting stabbed in his hand. He's like, ah, and he's fighting through it, and he's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a killer of men, and a tricker of men as well.
Does he do anything else to men?
Insults them, laughs at them.
An insulter of men.
An insulter of men. It's one of those guys. So it's him. John Getz is the fellow who's the cheating guy that's with the Frances McDormand is the wife cheating on her husband Dan Hedaya, with John Getz.
She's a weird looking lady.
She's a normal looking lady. She's normal looking. She's not movie. She doesn't look like your typical movie lady, and that served her over time. She's used that to her advantage and played a lot of great character roles again. Because the only people that put her in the lead of the movie.
Are the Coens.
And it just so happens that they met on this movie, and Frances McDormand and Joel Coen very shortly thereafter got married. And they've been married since.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So that's how that works.
So that's how that happened. Yep. That's how that one happened.
Okay.
And this was her first movie, Blood Simple. At that time, she was doing some theater stuff, trying to break into the business. Someone else auditioned for the part and for some reason couldn't do it. Not that she didn't want to or didn't get it, but she couldn't. Like, scheduling conflict or whatever. She was friends with Frances McDormand, suggested that she audition. Rest is
history,
as they say. Yeah. So, Blood Simple, like you said, guy hires a hitman to kill his wife and her lover. And then things go crazy from there. There's like, it's a simple setup, but then there's like a little plot twist here and there.
But there's blood involved, Chris.
There's a lot of blood involved, as a matter of fact. There's one 13-minute sequence where the lover, John Getz, who was also in The Fly, he has to transport a dead body, mm-hmm. and it's a 13-minute scene with no dialogue. It's him first, like, trying to clean up, and there's people in the next room, and it's all, like, just, like, really tense, and the music is very sparse and shit. Very, very much a horror film in that regard.
I have to say, well, you said, I mean, Sam Raimi.
The Sam Raimi influence there. So it's like a horror movie meets kind of an updated, like a noir, like a film noir type thing. But instead of it being in the old days, the old PI story, it's West Texas in the 80s.
I guess
neo-noir is what they call that.
I guess Blood Simple is the closest thing they've done to a horror movie.
Yeah, it's like almost like a horror modern western, which another movie that they did much later is also like a horror modern western.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
But so Blood Simple, the title is from a Dashiell Hammett novel, Red Harvest, in which Blood Simple is a term coined to describe the addled, fearful mindset people are in after a prolonged immersion in violent situations.
Some of that PTSD.
That PTSD, right. Dashiell Hammett, a noir writer, crime novelist from, I want to say the 50s. And I never read any Dashiell Hammett. I've read way more Raymond Chandler, a little bit of Jim Thompson. But it's along those same lines, the Philip Marlowe type stuff.
Okay.
And, like the Maltese Falcon or Big Sleep. That's what influenced a lot of the Coens work, obviously. I got a bunch of things here, but does that matter? That doesn't matter. All right, so this is the first movie of the Coen brothers. It's their directorial debut.
Yes.
It is also the debut of cinematographer Barry Sonnenfeld. Barry Sonnenfeld did their first three movies, and then he went on to become a director of his own, making these tiny little movies like Men in Black, stuff like that.
Tiny movies.
Wild Wild West, which didn't work out so well, but but he was a director.
So he was hanging with Will for a little while?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. He became a director in demand. Get Shorty.
Get Shorty was good.
Get Shorty is great. I love Get Shorty.
Men in Black was good. Wild Wild West was not.
Men in Black is fun. I love it. Get Shorty is great. Men in Black 2, meh. That was a writer's strike movie. I had problems. Wild Wild West is horrible.
Yeah.
Objectively horrible.
It's awful.
And then Men in Black 3, most recently, surprisingly, I liked it. Did you ever see it?
I don't think I've seen it.
It's one where Jermaine Clement plays the bad guy. He's great.
And Brolin plays young Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes. You ever saw that one? That's one worth tracking down and checking out. It's actually surprisingly good.
Interesting.
Surprisingly
good. I didn't think it would be. That's why I never even
I had no hopes for it whatsoever. And then when the movie was over, I was like, I like that.
Interesting.
I was ready to shit all over it.
Men in Black Trace.
Yeah, I was ready to shit all over that thing. I was like, no, this is entertaining. So Barry Sonnenfeld got his start with the Coens. And as I mentioned, Frances McDormand, it's her first film. Also doing his first collaboration as a composer with the Coens is Carter Burwell, who would go on to compose almost all of their film scores. And after Blood Simple, he himself became a very much in-demand composer. You know, so they helped him get his career going as well. Of all their movies, Blood Simple, their first one, is the only one to have been remade. It's been remade.
Who remade it?
In December of 2009, it was released as A Simple Noodle Story, directed by Zhang Yimou, who directed Hero and...
What?
House of Flying Daggers, I think.
He
remade a Coen Brothers movie. He set it in a noodle shop, in a Chinese noodle shop in a desert. It's a very loose remake.
Okay.
It's a loose remake, but he did publicly say when he started making this movie, it's like, I am remaking the Coen Brothers, but simple.
That's so fucking weird.
Yeah, it is weird, isn't it? It's called A Simple Noodle Story, but I think if we get it here, that's what it's called in China. Here, it's called A Woman, A Gun, and A Noodle Shop. Give it a more provocative title, I guess, there.
I would prefer A Simple Noodle Story.
Yeah, I think it's good. So Blood Simple, you know, it came out. It obviously didn't make very much money because it's not the type of movie that gets made. I mean, they had to go around for a year door to door. They literally went door to door to investors to raise enough money to just get the movie started. It took them a year to raise $750,000 to get the movie underway. But when it played at festivals, it got a lot of notice. People really liked it. And then, you know, it helped open the doors for them to get their next project made and to get more actors in there. I mean, the biggest actor for Blood Simple is probably Dan Hedaya, where if you look up Dan Hedaya, he's the type of guy who's like, oh, it's that guy. He's one of those guys. He's that guy. But, I mean, he's the biggest actor. Well, Frances McDormand now, but at that time, she was no one, right?
Nothing, yeah. Nobody.
Their next movie happened to star a young up-and-coming guy.
One of your favorites.
Known as Nicolas Cage. Yes. The great Nick Cage. Who can be great.
Can be.
Sometimes he's
not.
Horrible. Plain horrible. But sometimes he's fucking Nick Cage. As well as Holly Hunter?
Yes, Holly Hunter.
I keep mixing her up with Bonnie Hunt, name-wise.
Uh-huh.
Holly Hunter. I wanted to say Holly Hunt, which is a mix of... Yeah. Anyway. Randall Tex Cobb is the biker dude.
I love that guy.
That guy is great,
he's
right?
He's so awesome.
He did not know how to ride a motorcycle.
No.
He was like, right before they shot that, it's like, we need to learn how you... we need to find a way to make you not die on this thing. Here's a guy who's going to show you how to ride this bike. John Goodman.
Yeah. The first time and definitely not the last time you'll see John Goodman... In a Coen Brothers movie.
Yes, the beginning of a wonderful working relationship between those people. And, that's a great movie. The comedy.
Frances McDormand is in it again.
Frances McDormand, she pops up, I think, in at least six of their movies. Wow. In different...
we'll find
and,
out.
And at least one of them, she's just a voiceover.
Right now, we got two.
You got to pull up there. You want to read? What do they say in the IMDb? How do they describe this one?
When a childless couple of an ex-con and an ex-cop decide to help themselves to one of another family's quintuplets, their lives get more complicated than they anticipated.
Hi-yo. That's a crazy movie, man.
They kidnap a baby, but not, like, maliciously.
No, it's for sweet reason.
Yeah, they're like...
And that guy was on TV. He was like, "Oh, we got more than we can handle." And he's like, "See, boy, we got more than they can handle. We're gonna help them out.
We're gonna be helping them."
The scene where he's got to steal the diapers, and oh man, what a good movie. Edgar Wright's favorite film. Edgar Wright, he of Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead fame. While they were working on Blood Simple, they came up with the idea for Raising Arizona. And their idea, as they conceived of this project, they wanted it to be a much more... they wanted to make a comedy. They're like, after Blood Simple, which is, you know, that's every character in this movie is an asshole. They're all terrible. Even Frances McDormand. She plays a cheating wife. They're all horrible people. It's a downer of a movie. It's bloody, you know. They were like, we need to turn this thing around. We need to make a comedy. Mm-hmm. So that's how Raising Arizona came about. And then it's got a lot of that crazy slapsticky humor to it in terms of, you know, the physical comedy, like all the Tex Cobb versus Nick Cage stuff, you know, with the absurdity of all that, or like John Goodman coming up out of the ground, you know, when the guys broke out of prison and the way they come out of ground like that, they're like, ah, and you're screaming. That was all based on the screwball comedies of the 30s and 40s. The Coens at that time heavily referenced the director Preston Sturges, writer-director, who did pretty much the screwball comedy king of the 30s and 40s. All his movies are like that kind of style.
Mehmet was in this movie too.
Yeah, he's another one who pops up in a few. You know, directors do that. They work with people that they enjoy working with so much. Like, I mean, I don't know.
They're just like, hey, why don't you do this real quick?
Can you do this for me real quick over here, buddy, if you don't mind? And this is also going to be a running theme for the Coens. As much as like Blood Simple was, the critics liked it, everyone was like, oh yeah, this is a good movie. Raising Arizona got mixed reviews. They were like, we don't know what to make of this fucking thing. Since then, you know, it's been reevaluated like a lot of movies are, most movies are, and you know, people, it's much more well-reviewed, much more well-regarded now than it was when it initially came out in 87. It
happens a lot.
It does happen a lot. That was followed up in 1990, by Miller's Crossing, their Prohibition era crime drama, I guess you would call it.
Of sorts.
Also a bit of it's a thinly veiled story about a homoerotic relationship in the 30s that goes wrong, for sure.
Yeah.
The Gabriel Byrne's character is totally in love with Albert Finney's boss character. You know, and then they get in a fight and they got to break up. And at the end, they want to get back. Albert Finney's like, oh, can we get back together? And Gabriel Byrne's like, I can't do it. I can't do it, buddy. And then meanwhile, there's an overtly gay relationship in the movie between John Turturro's character and Steve Buscemi's character. And that actually plays a little bit into the plot where they're like, oh, this guy's a fruit, you know, so all that stuff being there. What's a little description there for in the
pretty much just said it. Tom Regan, an advisor to a Prohibition-era crime boss, tries to keep the peace between warring mobs but gets caught in divided loyalties.
Yeah, that, it's two mobs. There's Albert Finney is the head of the established mob, Irish mob, I think, in this town. And John Polito comes in. He's another guy who pops up in a lot of their movies. He's a short, bald guy. He's another one where you see that dude. He's that guy.
I've been going through this. There's a lot of those guys in their movies.
They work with a lot of those guys, which is great. John Polito, he's like, he has a warring mafia that moves into town, and they want to take over a lot of the business. And Gabriel Byrne tries to play both sides, kind of like a Yojimbo, Fistful of Dollars, Last Man Standing kind of deal. And it doesn't go so well. Doesn't go so well, even though he's just the smartest guy in the room. Doesn't always go well for him.
Frances McDormand's in this one again too.
I think that's the one where
she's the mayor's secretary.
Yeah, she's a secretary in that one.
Sam Raimi's the snickering gunman. Apparently,
he's another one where often you won't even see his face, or it's for like 1 second. Yeah. In the Hudsucker Proxy, jumping ahead a little bit, in Hudsucker Proxy, you see his outline. Like a projection on a wall, or you know, it's when a bunch of guys are trying to come up with a name for the hula hoop. You may remember the scene, trying to come up with a name, and you only see them through the glass that's like white glass, so you only see their outlines, and it's his voice too when they're like trying to come up with different names, and that's the kind of cameo Sam Raimi does. Guaranteed, the whole time he's wearing a suit. Now, Miller's Crossing is interesting. It had a budget somewhere between $10 and $14 million. So that's a pretty good budget for these guys, considering they only made two movies, and neither of them really made that much money. Raising Arizona did okay, but they got almost $14 million for this, and it ended up making about five. So that's good. Again, kind of a theme with the Coens. For all the... Oh, ignore it. No, I don't got... Oh, I made anything. Shit. Just a dog, man.
is not happening in this
is
episode.
Is not happening in this episode. Go to episode 115 for True Chicago versus Etchy from Enterpants. That was an exciting game, folks. Now, Miller's Crossing, I said earlier, it takes place in some city. The city is unidentified, but it was totally shot in New Orleans. And the reason they shot it there is because of all the original architecture. A lot of stuff there is still from the 20s. They don't change New Orleans. It's part of New Orleans' appeal. When you go there, go to the French Quarter, it's like, oh, this is what it was like 100 years ago almost, right? So that's part of the reason why they shot there. Plus, it helps that tax breaks and stuff like that. And now this is pretty funny, though. I'm sure this doesn't happen anymore, but this is a while ago, all right? During filming, the New Orleans police would arrive semi-regularly to assess fines for permits that the film crew had already procured. Joel Coleman commented to Premiere during shooting, "They're acting precisely like the cops that were depicted in the movie, and they don't even care." Which is pretty funny. It's good stuff. Miller's Crossing, I love it. It's a crazy movie. It's got like gallows humor. It's, you know,
it's one of my favorite Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah, it's damn good. It is damn good. Gabriel Byrne's great. Only time to work with Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah. He's awesome in that movie too.
And Albert Finney, who he was a last minute replacement for someone else who got sick or got injured.
Like, John Goodman.
No, not John. Not old Johnny Goodman. John Goodman though ended up being in the Coen Brothers' next movie, 1991's Barton Fink. Starring John Turturro as writer Barton Fink.
Not the last time you'll see him in a Coen
Brothers
movie.
Not the last time. They did another fruitful relationship
and,
there.
And in this one, this is the one where Frances McDormand is just her voice.
Okay.
So far, she's been in all of them.
Yeah, she has been.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Isn't that interesting? Like, come on, baby. Give us a little bit of that. Now, Barton Fink is about, before we get to the IMDb, I just want to say real quick, it's about a writer. Who he's a New York playwright, part of the literati, you know, high-minded. He goes to Hollywood to sell out to write a B-movie wrestling picture, gets writer's block, and then he makes friends with a neighbor who ends up being a serial killer. And the hotel he's staying at might be hell.
It could be. There's a very good, well, I mean,
at least a portal to hell.
Maybe one of the circles of.
There's something going on with hell with that hotel.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. 100%.
The Hotel Earl. Drew, what is the little IMDb? How do they want to try to sum up this weird, delightful movie that is Barton Fink?
I mean, you have said every word in this thing.
Well, how did they order the words?
A renowned New York playwright.
Oh, I said that.
Is enticed to California to write for the movies.
I said he sold out.
And discovers the hellish truth.
Oh, hell.
Of Hollywood. I don't know how you do it, Chris.
I should be writing.
You should. You should be writing this shit.
Stupid IMDb bunch of
morons.
John Turturro, the lead in this one.
John Goodman.
John Goodman, the guy in the next door. John Turturro's playing a writer. And he's writing on a typewriter. He actually went to a secretary school, which I guess they still had in the 90s, to learn how to use a typewriter properly. And then while on the set, between takes, you would keep tapping away at that typewriter, and that's where he banged out his first draft for his script, Romance and Cigarettes, which he went on to make in the 2000s and was produced by the Coens. Now, we mentioned Barry Sonnenfeld, cinematographer, went on to make a bunch of great movies himself. By this point, he already made the first three. He shot the first three Coen Brothers movies, and he was gone. He was out of there. So Coen Brothers needed a new cinematographer. That's the first time they hooked up with Roger Deakins. And it won't be the last. Roger Deakins, the great cinematographer who has been behind some of your favorite images in cinema for the last 20, 30 years or so. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't know it. It's one of those guys. One of those things. Now, again. This is almost the rule rather than the exception, really. When you look at it overall, it gets better for them as time goes on. But Barton Fink cost about $9 million to make.
Okay.
Not a lot of money. Not even in 91. Not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Grossed $5 million. So, not making money.
No.
The Coen Brothers.
No.
The movies ain't making money.
Well, I mean, depending on what they're doing, I mean, some of their stuff can be considered art house.
Well, yes. Yes, absolutely. As, that, a, as a matter of fact.
That shit doesn't make money, bro.
Producer Joel Silver, who went on after working on the Coens on this one, continued working with them on their next movie, Hudsucker Proxy, even after losing money on this, right? Mm-hmm. He says, the Coen brothers have a reputation for being weird, off-center, inaccessible.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, at this point in time, looking
for sure,
Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, I mean, there is not an accessible movie even on that list.
Raising Arizona, kind of, but even that, but it's still that weird
time,
enough. It's,
at that point in time, though.
It's still weird enough that it could, the style did turn people off, as you could see from the mixed reviews. Now, the reason Barton Fink was an utter failure is because it's brilliant. It's a fucking amazing movie. Mm-hmm. It's so good. How amazing is it? I'll tell you how amazing it is. 1991 Cannes Film Festival. Barton Fink is the first and only movie to win Best Director, Best Actor, and the Palme d'Or. Only movie to ever win all three of the major awards. After that happened, the Cannes Film Festival organizers changed rules that no movie could win more than two awards. So technically, that's why no other movie has done it since. But the movie was so good, they had to change the rules. Yeah. It's not like when Watchmen was named one of Time Magazine's 100 greatest novels of all time.
Yes.
And then immediately after that, the rules committee that put together that stupid bullshit list were like, we're not considering graphic novels anymore.
Ever again.
We don't know how this got on the list.
Why? Because it's fucking amazing. Because it's brilliant. Groundbreaking. Because
it's brilliant literature, you fuckheads. That's
it really,
why.
Seriously, it is one of the few comic books that I could argue is literature.
Yeah, that's real. Straight up. That'd be an interesting conversation to have with Barton Fink about the literary value of superhero movies and stuff like that, and comic book movies. Yeah. And yeah, because he's a bit of an ass.
I mean, it is a superhero movie, but it's not really. Because they're not superheroes.
It's got the framework. It's got the framework.
It's not superheroes that you know.
On top of the all the Cannes awards, it went on to be nominated for three Academy Awards: Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design.
So they threw Goodman a bone.
Not Goodman.
Not Goodman.
No.
Who's supporting?
Lerner? It just says his last name. Lerner?
Lerner.
Is it Jack Lerner?
Hang on.
I think that's the guy who played the head of the studio. The fat guy. He was like...
Michael.
Michael Lerner. Michael Lerner. And he lost to Jack Palance for City Slickers. So,
there we go.
And you know, fantastic movie. People, you got to watch it. As a matter of fact, if you haven't seen it or if you want to revisit it, it's on the Netflix.
Yes, it is.
As of right now. Coen Brothers movies pop up and off of Netflix all the time.
I'd like to see The Big Lebowski's been on there. The Hudsucker Proxy's been on there. Miller's Crossing's been on
there. Yeah, they've all been on there and they will be back. But Barton Fink is on there right now. If you're listening to this shortly after we release this episode. If you listen to this a year from now.
It may or may not be. We don't know.
Just do a search, man. Just pull up the app. It's easy.
Does Netflix even exist a year from now?
Dun, dun, dun. Now, Barton Fink was followed up by The Hudsucker Proxy. Again,
yes.
They co-wrote the screenplay with Sam Raimi in 85, but they didn't start making it until after they did Barton Fink in 91. Pretty much the story of the invention of the hula hoop. Not really, but that's just, you know, thrown in there for good fun.
You know, for kids.
For kids. Starring Tim Robbins and Paul Newman.
So great.
It's about what happens when a board of directors installs a dummy director to try to drive down the stock price so they can buy the company.
Bruce Campbell's in it.
Bruce Campbell's in it as an intrepid reporter. Uh-huh. Jennifer Jason Leigh is the main reporter in there.
Steve Buscemi.
I mean, again, Buscemi, he was in Barton Fink as the hotel clerk. He was in Miller's Crossing as the lover.
Like you said, Sam Raimi. And I've seen a lot. John Polito has come up in a lot of these movies as well.
He's another guy that, they work with him over and over and over again.
And John Goodman. He's the newsreel announcer.
Oh, they use his voice in that one?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. See? Why bother working with new people when he can just work with the same people that are all great? Now, Sam Raimi not only co-wrote the screenplay, but he was also a second unit director. Now, on a movie, you have, you know, your main director, and then a lot of times you have a second unit. A second unit is when you need you need pickup shots. You need a shot of like a car driving down the street, or you need a close up of hands doing something. Many directors don't want to be bothered with that stuff, yeah. or they rather do other things while that's getting done, because that's easier things to do, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when you have a second unit director. A lot of people get their, you know, directing onset chops by starting a second unit. Sam Raimi was their second unit director on one of their second unit directors on Hudsucker. The two scenes that he shot were the hula hoop sequence when it gets made, and then it's like going, you know, that whole sequence. He shot all that, and the suicide in the beginning, warring Hudsucker suicide.
It's a great shot.
It's all great. Yeah, the straight up Sam Raimi.
It's so funny that at that point in time, the Coen brothers, as their second unit director, is a director who's technically, by Hollywood standards, better than them.
Yeah, I mean, he's already had successes, and he was already getting ready to work on Army of Darkness by that point.
It's like,
but they were buddies.
It's like when Kobe Bryant started having Michael Jordan as his backup.
Yeah, hey, back me up, bro. Back me up. Now, Joel Silver, who worked with them on Barton Fink, helped produce this one. He wanted Tom Cruise for the lead role.
Ooh.
Yeah, which would have been, you know, I mean, he would have been fine. He's Tom Cruise.
But he's so short. Especially in that
movie magic. Well, especially they end up casting Tim Robbins, who's so huge.
That's what I'm saying. Tim Robbins is so huge. And then like, a lot of those scenes.
Well, they play with that. Yeah, they use his height and the awkwardness of him.
Exactly.
It would have been a little. Yeah, it would have been different, obviously, with Tom Cruise. Imagine this movie. Tom Cruise as, what's the character's name? Norval Barnes. And, Winona Ryder and Bridget Fonda both auditioned for the role of Amy, the reporter, ended up going to Jennifer Jason Leigh. Jennifer Jason Leigh really got that part because she had auditioned for the previous Coen Brothers movies and didn't get the parts, but they liked her so much that they ended up using her. But imagine Hudsucker Proxy starring Tom Cruise and Winona Ryder.
What?
Right? Right? Wouldn't that have been a weird movie. Mm-hmm. Premiered at the Sundance Film Festival January 94. It screened at the Cannes Film Festival, and it was in competition for the Palme d'Or, but a little movie called Pulp Fiction won it that year.
Yeah.
And then, again, the Coens. Guys, it's a miracle that they got to make the movies that they got to make at this point. Official budget of $25 million, and they're known for coming in at budget. Mm-hmm. Right, so probably no more than $25 million. Ended up grossing in America about $2.8 million.
No,
even less than their previous films. And it's more, you would even think that movie is more accessible than something like Miller's Crossing or Barton Fink. But America was just not having Tim Robbins and Jennifer Jason Leigh in a 1940s set screwball comedy.
It's so
even weird. With Paul Newman in it.
I know. Paul Newman's like, he's gold.
Yes. And he is in this movie. He's so good in this movie.
He's always gold.
He's so good in the movie.
He's just so good, Chris. He's fucking Paul Newman.
He was Paul Newman.
He was.
He was Paul Newman.
You can still see his face on salad dressing bottles.
Now that you can. That suicide is inspired by a real life incident. February 3rd, 1975. Eli Black, the CEO of United Fruit, smashed an office window with his briefcase.
Untied fruit,
and he jumped to his death from the 44th floor of the Pan Am building.
Ooh.
So he went to splat, and that's where they got the idea for Warren Hutsucker's awesome suicide. Now, I mean, at this point, the Coen's like, if our next movie isn't some sort of a hit, we may never get to make movies ever again.
So they made a hit?
So fortunately, they had an idea for a little movie called Fargo.
Tiny little movie,
which is currently on the Netflix Instant. Barton Fink and Fargo are only two movies on Netflix Instant. What does IMDb say about the Fargo? How do they try to describe that fucking caper of a film?
Jerry Lundegaard's inept crime falls apart due to his and his henchmen's bungling and the persistent police work of the quite pregnant Marge Gunderson.
Very pregnant Marge Gunderson, Frances McDormand. The hero of the film. Almost the lead character, kind of a co-lead with William H. Macy's Jerry Lundegaard.
Yeah.
Doesn't show up in the movie until about 33 minutes in.
But for some reason, when I think Fargo, I think Frances McDormand.
Because she's Marge Gunderson. Mm-hmm. Because she's great. That's why. She's so great. She won Academy Award for Best Actress. She won National Board Review Award for Best Actress, the SAG Award for Outstanding Performance by a Female Actor in a Leading Role. I mean, she's great. She's so good in that movie.
Yeah.
Also helps that it's extremely well written.
It's the Coens.
It's Fargo. And that's the one where, like, really put them on the map. That's the one that got everyone's fucking attention.
Well, yeah, I mean, without Fargo, there probably would be no Coen brothers.
Probably.
There would just be these guys who made these couple movies.
Made these bunch of weird movies in the 90s. They didn't make any money, and they ended up doing commercials for the rest of their lives.
Exactly.
Right? But no, Fargo ended up fucking being a big deal. In 2006, it was added to the Library of Congress, the National Film Registry. The first of all their movies to have been inducted. Mm-hmm. And then it's got the whole thing where the based on a true story.
Yeah.
Right? And it's really not. And then it's like, you ask them, and they're like, well, there's no actual case. I mean, this is based on people that we knew growing up. But, I mean, none of this happened in the way it happened. Like, things like this happened.
I'm about to say, it's totally plausible.
The reason that they said that they started the movie with based on true story is because then if audiences see that in front of a movie, then they're willing to suspend their disbelief even more.
Yeah.
Which tells you a lot about movies and the way people perceive them. If you give them a certain information before you watch the movie, they'll see it a different way, perception and all that. And they're smart enough to be able to take advantage of that and point out that you can almost call it a flaw in the way people take in art and they watch things. On top of the win for Frances McDormand for Best Actress, the Coens also won Best Original Screenplay, and it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor for William H. Macy, Best Cinematography, and it was the first nomination for film editing for the Coens. The Coens' editor, Roderick Janes. Roderick Janes is the name of their grandfather? Their great-grandfather?
Okay.
The Coens edited their own films. They edit their own movies, but they use nom de plume, a pseudonym.
Yes,
they use another name,
pen name,
and it's Roderick Janes. And then he got nominated for an award. And if he ever wins, who's going? The presenter is going to accept it. The idea is that the presenter will accept it on behalf. They'll say Roderick Janes going to be here tonight.
Okay.
Not this award ceremony, but a future Academy Award ceremony where Roderick Janes was nominated again. And, you know, they have up on the screen, they show the pictures of the nominees. And when they had a picture of Roderick Janes, it was just some old dude. It was probably their grandfather.
Yeah,
it was an old black and white photo of some old dude. Those jokesters.
It was probably their grandfather. They're like, you know what? Screw this. We're getting our grandfather's picture on the Oscars.
Yeah. Those hucksters, those guys. Mentioned at the top of the show, they grew up in Minneapolis, you know, in Minnesota, that whole Minnesota nice thing.
Minnesota,
where everyone's like that veneer of almost superficial niceness. Everyone's nice to a fault.
Yeah.
And then there's that underlying cynicism and violence and anger and, you know, just like the rest of America, except over there, they found a way to cover it up with smiles and politeness, over the top politeness. They incorporate all that stuff that they knew into the movie. Pretty much, you know, they wrote about what they knew, and they came out with something amazing.
It's odd how that works in the creative process.
It's weird, right?
For some reason, the more truthful and honest you are with your experiences and putting your experiences out there, people for some reason connect to it.
They respond to it more than if you try to make something up.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Now, we all know Fargo, the TV show on FX, last year, you know, they did season one.
It was good.
It was surprisingly good. I was very, very pessimistic about it being any good. Like, Fargo is an amazing movie. Who thinks that they can just translate this into some sort of TV show and make it work? But some dude made it work.
Yeah.
Like, really well.
I was about to say, they made it work.
I'm looking forward to season two. I hope it's as good.
So am I.
But did you know, Drew, that was not the first attempt to make Fargo into a TV show?
Interesting.
In 1997, Fargo was fresh. It just won all these awards. A pilot was made starring Kathy Bates. No, it was directed by Kathy Bates, which is weird. Starring Edie Falco from the Sopranos as Marge Gunderson. And remember They're driving down her partner, yeah. not the husband. That's John Carroll Lynch, but her partner, the idiot who's like, "Oh, I put you just had DLR, so I thought it was like put out an APB for DLR plates." Mm-hmm. And she's like, "I think those are dealer plates." That dude, he was reprising his role. So he was like the one person to come back from the movie. The only did, and the Coens were not involved
at all.
They really weren't involved with the TV show either. But so, only the pilot never got picked up. And it did air on the, and this, I barely remember this series. And I wish they would kind of do something like it. First off, you remember Trio? The TV channel Trio? Early 2000s? They were around for a minute. I don't know what they are now, but I don't think Trio anymore.
No, you don't remember Trio?
I remember Trio. They had one thing, they did a whole thing on comedy where it was like, is it offensive, pretty much? And it was just all this hard-edge comedy and, you know, question was, is it offensive or is it funny? Or is it both? They did a whole thing called Brilliance but canceled.
Okay.
And it was all TV shows that they deemed great and never got picked up or got canceled or whatever. And the pilot for the Fargo, 90s Fargo show aired there back in 2003. So now they're riding high, right? Fargo, it makes money, it wins awards. Finally, the Coens have some success. They decide to follow that up with
some more success.
It's debatable. Compared to Fargo, not really. Because we're talking about the Big Lebowski. Big Lebowski did not have immediate success.
Immediate, no.
No. Big Lebowski, it cost them... What does it even say here? It would help if I had a budget. It ended up making $46 million. None of their movies cost more than like 20 tops. I mean, this one probably cost them 15 to make, especially after Fargo. Ends up making 46 worldwide. So when you throw in marketing and all that stuff, it's more of a break-even thing when it comes to box office. Mm-hmm. Also, reviews-wise, compared to Big Lebowski, compared to Fargo, which was universally loved, Big Lebowski got very mixed reviews. Some people thought it was great, and some people were not jiving with it at all.
In retrospect,
now... there's Lebowski Fest.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah. Which started in Kentucky, but now it goes around the country. It's even attended at times by like Jeff Bridges and shit like that, you know, which is amazing.
Well, Jeff Bridges is a weird dude.
He's a weird guy. I went to Lebowski Fest once here in Orlando 4 years ago. Were you there?
No. I was working nights then.
I think I was with it's me, Maddie J, and someone else, a couple other people. And it was just, he show up. It was at a bowling alley. We got lanes. We met the people next to us. Like, they joined us. Like, hey, yeah, you like Big Lebowski? Yeah, we like Big Lebowski. And then, you know, everyone starts from there.
Yeah.
They were selling, they had pictures of pre-made white Russians at the bar because, they had, you know, obviously we were going to be drinking that. So we got some white Russians just because. And then we drank, like, these aren't very good because they didn't make them very good. It was a fucking bowling alley. And then we switched to beer. They had a costume contest, which was a lot of fun. There was one guy that was dressed as a can of Slice, orange Slice. And I had to be like, why is that guy... dressed as a can of orange Slice, and someone had to tell me that Donnie drinks orange Slice in the movie. I was like, damn, that's a fucking detail, bro. Like, I mean, I see a bunch of Walter Sobchaks, here's some dudes, here's some really good looking dudes. Like, these dudes are dudes, you know, those are some good dudes.
Any Jesus's?
Jesus's walk around in the purple outfits. There was like at least four of them, yeah. There were at least that four scene, of them, and at least one of them was good.
That scene where he shines his ball is one of the fucking most hilarious things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Him and his buddy Liam.
Yeah.
Me and Liam, man. We're going to fuck you up. Now, much like their
previous... You care what IMDb says about this movie?
Oh, yeah. What does IMDb say?
The dude, Lebowski, mistaken for a millionaire Lebowski, seeks restitution for his ruined rug and enlists his bowling buddies to help get it.
Yep. Which... John Goodman and Steve Buscemi. Again, all coming back.
Vinylis for Kevin Nussing.
Is this the first Coen Brothers movie to not have Frances McDormand? I believe so.
No, I don't think the last movie did.
Oh, you mean Fargo? Yeah.
No, Hudsucker Proxy. I don't think she was in.
Wasn't she the voiceover in that one?
No, it was Barton Fink.
So she wasn't in Okay, so no Hudsucker Proxy, no Big Lebowski. There you go. So she was in the first four, and then Fargo, that's five. Something like that. So like earlier movies were inspired by Dashiell Hammett, this one was more inspired by Raymond Chandler.
John Polito's in this one again, though. I think he might be in all of them, Chris.
John Polito played the brother, I'm a brother Seamus. You mean like an Irish monk? It's like, no, I'm a private dick like you. Yeah, he's that guy. Oh, he's so good. I love John Polito. He's so funny.
I think he's in all of them.
Has he been in so far? Should we be keeping track of him instead of Francis McDormand?
I think we should.
Who was he in Fargo?
Hang on.
He wasn't in Fargo. So there you go. There goes that one. Now, here's a Joel Cohen quote about the influence of Raymond Chandler and those type of noir stories on The Big Lebowski. He says, quote, "We wanted to do a Chandler kind of story, how it moves episodically and deals with the characters trying to unravel a mystery, as well as having a hopelessly complex plot that's ultimately unimportant," which is definitely a big component of movie. Like I already mentioned, Maltese Falcon and big stories like that. Long Goodbye, even something as recent as Thomas Pynchon's Inherent Vice, which Pete Sanderson made. The plot gets convoluted, overly complex, and in the end, it doesn't matter that much because it's not about the plot. It's about the mood and the atmosphere and the characters and the dialogue and shit like that, you know? And Big Lebowski is very much like that. It's about these weird characters and their interactions with each other more so than trying to find out who kidnapped Bunny Lebowski and getting her back, you know? Because ultimately, no one cares about Tara Reid.
Yeah, no.
Philip Seymour Hoffman working with the Coen brothers in this one. Right. Made for $15 million. It grossed $17 in the U.S. Another $28 over gross of $46 million for The Big Lebowski. The dude's line, "The dude abides," is a reference to, want to take a guess?
No idea.
Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 4. Quote. That's the Bible, Drew. Quote, "One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever."
And the dude abides.
The dude abides. That's a reference to how the dude, much like the earth, can weather change and chaos around him, but still remain the same.
He's the dude.
Now, remember the scene where the dude, like, after he has coitus with Maud?
Yes.
Like, you mean coitus? You mean sex? You mean you know the guy? After they have sex, and he's like telling him, he's like, I was part of the Seattle Seven. You know, it's me and six other dudes. All that. That's based on a real guy who really was part of the Seattle Seven. The dude, like whoever the dude's based on. But he says that he was a roadie for Metallica on the Speed of Sound tour, which is a fake tour. Mm-hmm. And he said they're a bunch of assholes. Apparently, Metallica loved that. They love that they're referencing the Coen Brothers movie, and even. Kirk Hammett, the guitarist, noted in an interview that they tried to find a way to incorporate that scene into their live shows.
Nice. Yeah. So they just got to be assholes. That's all.
Yeah, they were totally
all
fine.
All they had to be like, Lars, you take front, okay?
You're good. So yeah, financial, not a failure, but not making money, not like Fargo, not getting any awards, not much critical consideration like Fargo. So it is considered a bit of a step back for them in those terms. But now, you know, cult classic, everyone loves it. It's a big fucking Lebowski.
Two words. Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott, the cowboy.
That's all I have to say.
He's the cowboy, man.
So good in that fucking
sometimes
movie.
Sometimes we bar and, well, sometimes the bar. It eats you. Now, all the cadences of that movie, like the way Sam Elliott talks, the dudes, all his like ums and us. He's like, she like kidnapped herself, man.
Dude.
Yeah, all those things, all of them are written in the script. No one improvised nothing. Yeah. Every little stop and pause and us and all that was like written in there. Like, this is how you gotta say it. It's like, oh, I think you missed an There was like in Fargo. Quick story about Fargo. Yeah, I think you missed a number there. You got to go back and do the whole scene all over again. In Fargo, Peter Stormare, the guy who's the he's Finnish, I think, but he plays like a German or whatever in that movie. He's like, "We go to Pancake's house." Remember, he says that's a Steve Buscemi.
Sure.
He's and where they're driving the car. And he goes, "We go to Pancake's house," and then he's looking at the script. He's like, "That can't be right." So when they do the scene, you go to action. He gets to him. So we go to Pancake House, and they're like, "Cut! Wait, cut!" It's like, "Can you read that again?" He goes, "Well, it says you go to pancakes." Yeah, read it like that. It's like, "Oh, I thought that was a typo." And the Coens go, "No, there are no typos in our script. There are no typos. It reads as Pancake House. That's important." Big Lebowski, not much of a hit. But in 2000, they come out with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Correct.
Their first film with George Clooney.
Yes.
John Goodman comes back.
Yes.
John Turturro comes back.
Yep.
Now, Oh Brother made a good amount of money off of a $26 million budget, which is, again, their higher end for budgets. It grossed $71 million. I think that's here in the U.S. 73rd Academy Awards. It was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Cinematography.
Nice.
But what really made this movie popular was the soundtrack, the music. Because it's all about that that old bluegrass stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
How does IMDb describe it? Did they throw in any Odyssey references in their shorthand?
In the Deep South during the 1930s.
30s South.
Three escaped convicts search for hidden treasure while a relentless lawman pursues them.
Yeah.
I mean, all that's the truth. Sounds but about it really doesn't get to it.
It doesn't really sum it up, though, right? Because there's a lot going on in Oh Brother. It's a road movie, but it's also a buddy movie. But then, like I said, it's a take on the Odyssey. You know, there's a Cyclops and sirens and all that stuff. But the thing about that is the Coens have never read Odyssey. They just know all the story beats because it's the Odyssey. It's one of the oldest, you know,
really,
pieces of drama.
They never read Odyssey.
They never read Odyssey.
I had to read it in high school.
So did I.
It was awful.
So did I.
It's not written well.
It's a poem. It's a long poem.
Like I said, it's not written well.
I mean, it was written well for...
Well, I mean, in Greek, it probably makes a whole lot more fucking sense than it does in English.
In modern English? But that soundtrack, the soundtrack for Oh Brother, is what really, really blew up. Where we go? It won the Grammy for Album of the Year in 2001, which would be impressive if the Grammys meant anything, but they don't.
Yeah.
It sold 5 million copies by early 2001. It spawned a documentary film. This is the soundtrack. Three follow-up albums. Oh, Sister, Worked Out. Oh, Sister, Worked Out, too. Weird. Two concert tours. And it won Country Music Awards for Album of the Year and Single of the Year for Man of Constant Sorrow. That song was everywhere for a year or two. That Man of Constant Sorrow shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, the Grammys, which are worth it, so it won five of those, including the Album of the Year. And hit number one on the Billboard album charts 63 weeks after its release and over a year after release of the film.
Wow.
So it just kept going and going and going. That Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The beginning of the Idiots trilogy with George Clooney, which is being expanded into a quadrilogy. The Man Who Wasn't There, 2001.
Correct.
Billy Bob Thornton.
Yes.
First time working with him. James Gandolfini. First time working with him. Roger Deakins. Shoots it again, black and white. Richard Jenkins is in it.
The return of John Polito.
The return. The triumphant return of John Polito, who plays the guy who tries to sell people on the dry cleaning business. He's trying to get money to start up dry cleaning. It's the beginning of dry cleaning.
Tony Shalhoub's back.
Tony Shalhoub, Monk, is back. He was in Barton Fink. And might be big screen debut. I think it's her first movie. Very young. Not very young. Young enough that he should feel creepy watching it.
Scarlett Johansson. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Who at one point offers Billy Bob Thornton's character a blowjob.
Yep.
Not just a blowjob. Roadhead.
Hopefully Billy took it.
No. He was like, heavens to Betsy. And then they got into a car accident. The Man Who Wasn't There, black and white film. It's this one is back to the noir thing. Billy Bob Thornton plays a barber who is going to blackmail his wife's lover. Is that what that says on IMDb? No? You're shaking your head now.
Yes.
Oh, that's what it says?
You just keep saying what I'm about to read.
And then it goes wrong. I don't know how it finishes. What does it say?
Damn it.
What does it say?
A laconic chain-smoking barber.
Yeah, chain-smoking, yeah.
blackmails his wife's boss and lover for money to invest in dry cleaning. But his plan goes terribly wrong.
Terribly wrong. Terribly wrong. So
incredibly wrong.
So incredibly wrong. Now, I love this movie. Nominated for Best Cinematography. Only nomination it got for any award. Didn't win because Roger Deakins never wins. He's a Susan Lucia cinematographer. Does people even get that Susan Lucci reference anymore?
No.
I don't think so, right? That's an old reference.
Yes.
We need,
you're ancient.
Roger Deakins is the Roger Deakins of cinematographers.
Exactly.
Now, look at it this way. This is very interesting. I remember reading this in a Francis McDormand interview forever ago. Look at Fargo, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and then Black and White. And then the black and white. And Man Who Wasn't There, which is in black and white. Those movies, it's a progression to the black and white movie. Fargo is a lot of whites.
Yeah.
Because it's all in the snow, yes. Right? Oh Brother was digitally graded so that it had a sepia tone.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And then next movie, Man Who Wasn't There, straight up black and white. So it was like a progression up to that. With a budget of $20 million at a worldwide box office take of 18.9. Mm. So, again, not making money at the box office, but like we mentioned earlier, this is one of those arty Coen Brothers movies.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just the fact that it's black and white. People are like, I don't want to see a black and white movie because, you know, they're stupid.
It's like when a movie has subtitles. I don't want to read subtitles.
I don't
want to
read subtitles. Yeah, exactly.
But then you miss out, and then.
But then you miss what they're saying.
And then Das Weisband comes out, and it's both black and white and with subtitles. Nobody sees it.
No one.
One of the greatest movies I think I've ever seen.
No one knows Das Weisband. I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Those kids. Yep. That's Children of the Corn type shit,
bro. That was some real Children of the Corn. Nazis of the Corn. Now, this is an interesting little time period here for the Coens following up The Man Who Wasn't There, which at that point is like they're almost their ultimate art house film because it has all their hallmarks of the dark comedy and the noir elements and the murder, you know, all that stuff's in there.
It's in black and white.
But then it's in black and white. Billy Bob Thornton is like lacking affectation 100%, which works great for the movie, but he's totally just like a blank slate, right? It's a weird story that involves dry cleaning, and then there's this thing with UFOs that pops up, and at the end that makes no sense, and then it ends on a bummer,
mm-hmm.
a huge bummer ending. It's almost the epitome of their art of the Coen Brothers' art film at that point. Where can they go from there? They directed their first movie that wasn't written by them, at least not totally. They gave the screenplay a pass, but the screenplay had already been written. They did Intolerable Cruelty in 2003. Their first real attempt, and I think still their only attempt, at a straight-up romantic comedy. A rom-com.
Romantic dark comedy.
It gets dark because it's the Coens. It can't not get dark. No. So they're going to have a character named Wheezy, who's a hitman, and then he accidentally shoots himself because he thinks he's grabbing his inhaler, and he grabs his gun and shoots himself in the mouth. That's what you get when you make a Coen Brothers rom-com.
Yes.
But if you take out some of those scenes, otherwise it is just pretty much a rom-com. Mm-hmm. You know? How does I mean? What do they say?
A revenge-seeking gold digger.
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Marries a womanizing Beverly Hills lawyer.
George Clooney.
With the intention of making a killing in the divorce.
A killing, ayo! Because people get killed.
Every time I watch this movie, I just agree with the title. That movie really is intolerably cruel.
Yeah, it's just...
Those two people are like the worst people on the planet to each other.
They're shitty people, and the movie's just not that good. There's a reason why it didn't get made right away. For a while in the 90s, Ron Howard was going to direct it. Then John Demme, who did Silence of the Lambs, he was going to direct it. At one point, the plan was to have it star Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant in the late 90s.
Okay, yeah, I could have seen that.
Yeah, they were super popular at that time, right? Coen Brothers only ended up doing it because they were working on a project called To the White Sea, an adaptation of a book, To the White Sea, which is about... Air Force pilot, like an army pilot or something, who crash lands by himself in like the fucking Arctic, and then he has to walk out of the Arctic and save himself. So the whole movie would have been one person by himself in snow.
All is lost.
It would have been All is Lost in the snow.
Frozen All is Lost.
Frozen All is Lost, starring Brad Pitt, because it was gonna be starring Brad Pitt.
I'd go see that movie,
and then it never happened, and it never will.
I watched All Is Lost. I'll go see another movie like that.
Now, Intolerable Cruelty, not, you know, the reviews probably the weakest reviewed. No, the second weakest reviewed of all their movies, most likely. And time has not been kind to it. It's not like it's getting any reappraisals like a Big Lebowski or a Race in Arizona. But on a $60 million budget, made $120 million worldwide.
Oh, there you go.
On that George Clooney, Catherine Zeta-Jones back, you know. So, some commercial success. They were able to move on to their next movie. Came out the very next year. Their first remake of a movie. They remade the 1955 British comedy The Lady Killers.
Correct.
With Tom Hanks,
mm-hmm.
J.K. Simmons,
mm-hmm.
Marlon Wayans.
Yeah.
And I think, was Casey Affleck in that? Maybe. Or am I just thinking of an Oceans movie? I might just be thinking of an Oceans movie.
You're thinking
movie.
Oceans.
So yeah, it's a remake of a British movie about some dudes that want to rob a casino and they have to use some lady's like house to dig the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And this movie's a little unfortunate.
It's the only Coen Brothers movie I haven't seen.
Really? I mean, like, for completest reasons, it's worth checking out. Yeah, no. I mean, obviously there are some parts of it that are okay. There's a funny running montage. That's just from the original movie anyway, but it's a running joke about how Tom Hanks is leading this team of people, like a bumbling Ocean's 11, to try to rob a casino. And one by one, they're dying throughout the movie. And they have to keep disposing of the bodies. And they dispose of them the same way by throwing them off a bridge. And each shot is the same. It's always a wide shot of the bridge as a trash barge is going underneath it. And they dump the body onto the bridge. And then somehow they work it so that Tom Hanks is the last one to die. But I think he dies on the bridge. And then he falls over and he lands on the barge. Yeah. And then it takes him away. The most important thing about the Lady Killers is how it is the first movie of all their movies in which the produced by and the directed by credits say Joel and Ethan Coen. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, Joel was the director.
Yes,
quote director. Yes. Ethan, the
was
producer.
The quote producer.
Right. That was only because of Guild rules and regulations that it was almost impossible up to that point. It was almost impossible to have two people share a credit, and it wasn't always that way, but you know, things change over time and they have since changed again. So up until 2004, it was too much of a pain in the ass to get them both listed as directors, so they just found that way to split it up. They didn't care. They knew that they worked on everything together. But from that point forward, from Lady Killers forward, all the movies say Joe and Ethan Coen, which is, you know, it's more representative of the two-headed beast. Mm-hmm. Budget of $35 million. Got that Tom Hanks salary, is, you know, gotta cover that salary. Box office of $76 million total. So, now Total Cruelty was 2003. Lady Killers was 2004. It took them a few years to figure out exactly what they're gonna do next, but they got it. Someone handed them, Scott Rudin, this producer, handed them a book that was about to be published, not published yet. They got the galley version of the book. Mm-hmm. The book was Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. If you ask the Coen brothers how they adapted this book, they say that they sat down at the computer, they opened up the book, and then they
hit print.
And then they copied over. Like, what does it say? Okay, copy. You know, they just transfer it over. And if you read the two, they are very, very similar. But I mean, it's a little facetious to say it was that simple. They had to do some things, change some characters, but you know, they made an amazing movie.
Yeah. So yeah, totally.
It's No Country for Old Men, which is how do they want to try to describe that one? About a guy who finds some money.
Violence and mayhem ensue after a hunter stumbles upon a drug deal gone wrong.
Yeah.
And more than $2 million in cash near the Rio Grande.
Nope. Yep. Josh Brolin.
Yep.
Is the hunter. Javier Bardem plays Anton Chigurh, who is less of a person and more of just like
a tool. He is a killer.
He is like violence personified. He is a force of nature.
He just rolls
through the movie and destroys everything in his way.
What I like is how calm he is. He just walks up to people and he asks them questions, and then he puts the cattle killer to their forehead just very calmly and dunk, and then gets in their car and drives away.
Because he's a psychopath.
I love it. He is one of my most favorite movie villains of all time.
Now, the Coen brothers, they approached Bardem and they said, hey, we want you to play this guy. He didn't audition for it or nothing. They're like, we want you. He told them, I don't drive, I speak bad English, and I hate violence.
Well, guess what? Learn to drive, we don't care about your English, and you're going to be one of the most violent motherfuckers on the planet.
Actually, the Coens responded, that's why we called you. And he took the role, Bardem took it ultimately because it's the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
He just wanted to work with the Coen brothers, he said it was a dream. Now, Josh Brolin at the time, when they're making this movie, he was working on Grindhouse with Robert Rodriguez. He heard about the part. He wanted to play Llewellyn Moss, the hunter. But he was like, damn, I need to make an audition tape. It's like, hey, maybe these guys help me out make an audition tape. Hey, Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino, come over here.
Let's make an audition tape for the Coen brothers.
You guys help me make this audition tape? So they made an audition tape, and it was fucking directed by Quentin Tarantino. The Coen brothers, they saw the tape, And their response was that they loved the lighting. Now, obviously, it worked because he got the role. Now, back to Bardem. Won at the 80th Academy Awards, February 2008. He won a supporting actor Oscar. Now, this tripped me up a little bit here. I had to like do some digging on this. I've seen in multiple places where it says here, Javier Bardem winning supporting actor at that Academy Awards. The first Spanish actor to win an acting award, which then made me think, what about Benicio Del Toro, who won Best Supporting Actor in 2000 for Traffic? I even went back and looked that up. I was like, am I making that up? Did I imagine that whole acceptance speech and that whole thing about him being the first Puerto Rican to win an award? Was that a dream? And no, it really happened. There's footage of it on YouTube and everything. I was like, look, there he is as a Spanish guy winning an award for acting. How come he doesn't count? So apparently Puerto Ricans aren't Spanish.
Hey, you're not Spanish, Chris.
News to me.
Good job.
So I don't know what I am now.
You're not Spanish.
So what am I?
You are brown American.
If I'm in the sun for a while.
I mean, Chris, I'm pretty sure I get darker than you in the sun.
Yeah, right? So what does that make you?
White.
That makes no sense. These semantics make no sense whatsoever. Now, this is the second Best Picture winner, because the one Best Picture that year, same year that There Will Be Blood was nominated. That's a hell of a twofer right there, right? It was the second Best Picture Award winner to be produced, directed, written, and edited by the same person. In this case, two people, because it's the
two others.
The only other movie to win Best Picture that was produced, directed, written, and edited by the same person... I'll tell you the person, you tell me the movie. How about that?
Okay.
James Cameron.
Avatar?
Titanic,
right? Titanic. He edited that crap fest himself.
Yeah, he does everything. He's a man who wears many, 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 many hats. Many hats. And Avatar did not win Best Picture. That was when the Hurt Locker.
That whole thing. That was so good.
That whole thing. That's why it won. You gotta be right. That's gotta be why it won. That's gotta be the reason Avatar was even nominated to begin with. Just so you can be like, now we're gonna give it to her.
Ha!
Your ex-wife to the movie that cost your catering budget on your movie was how much this movie cost.
Yeah.
We're gonna give it to them. Now, there's that scene, there's a sequence in the movie where Josh Brolin's character goes into Mexico and then he's at the hospital and then he fucks back into America.
Yes.
The first and only time so far in Coen Brothers' OVOR in which a scene is set outside of America.
Huh.
Yep. First time they left America. And nominated for 8 Academy Awards, won 4. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay. And Javier Bardem for Best Performance by Actor in a Supporting Role. Nominations include Best Film Editing, Roderick James. Cinematography, Deakins, lost again. And Best Sound Editing and Sound Mixing, because, sound. Budget, $25 million, $171 million gross worldwide. So, hit!
Cha-ching!
Yes, cha-ching.
My favorite part about this movie is how everyone was so angry that they didn't get to see Josh Brolin die.
That is hysterical. People hate that. And I'm just thinking, if you read the book, you would hate it even more. Because at least in the movie, you get to see like the bad guys leave the scene... And he rolls up on the body, and you see the body. He's like, oh, shit. In the book, it happens between chapters. Like, one chapter, he's alive, and then you turn the next page, and then Tommy Lee Jones' character, he's, like, identifying his body at the morgue, and someone saw him. Yep, they shot him. They shot him, and no one was around for it.
I don't understand why people get so angry about it.
Because it's the rug being pulled out from under them. It's we follow this guy for so long.
But Josh Brolin isn't the main character.
No, he's not. No, Tommy Lee Jones is the main character.
Yes.
And, like, in Fargo.
What's the name of the movie?
No Country for Josh Brolin.
Who's the old man?
The old man. Josh Brolin's not that old.
No, he's not. Tommy Lee Jones is the old man. It's about Tommy Lee Jones.
And like in Fargo, where Marge Gunderson shows up 30 minutes in, our main hero of this movie shows about 20 minutes in.
No.
And unlike Marge Gunderson, who is tenacious, never gives up, the old man gives up.
He does.
He's like, this is no country for me.
He's like, fuck this. This is ridiculous.
This country has grown beyond my reasoning. And then, like Blood Simple, like their first movie, it seems to mash together contemporary Western with horror, because some of those scenes are so tense and so crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's no goddamn no country for old men. Followed that up with a spy farce. I mean, how could, again, it's like they followed up Blood Simple with Raised in Arizona.
Yeah.
No Country was so heavy. Like, we gotta flip.
We gotta
this.
Lighten it up.
We gotta lighten it up. Burn after reading. First time Roger Deakins to not shoot their movie since Miller's Crossing. He was busy working on something else. So the Coens got Emmanuel Lubezki, who was pretty fresh off of Children of Men at that point.
Great movie.
Now, you know, again, this one, No Country for Old Men, was their first movie that they adapted from a book. The movie before that, Lady Killers, was their first remake. And then the movie before that was written by someone else in the 90s, and they came on. Burn After Reading is their first original screenplay since The Man Who Wasn't There in 2001. So they went back to writing their own shit for this one. And, it's got George Clooney, again, right. Coming back for the Between No Brother. And this, and what's this?
Brad Pitt's in the movie.
And what's the other? And Intolerable Cruelty. Yes. Keep reading Intolerable Cruelty. Those are three that consist of the original Idiot trilogy for George Clooney. They're making a fourth one, though. And Brad Pitt, Frances McDormand's back.
Tilda Swinton's
in it. Roger Deakins is, Richard Jenkins is back.
John Malkovich.
Because he was in The Man Who Wasn't There. John Malkovich is fantastic. John Malkovich as Osborne Cox. J.K. Simmons has a role as CIA guy in a couple scenes. He doesn't pop up to the very end, but he's great in his couple of scenes. He's so funny. And how does the IMDb say about it? It's not a guy. He cheats.
A disc containing the memoirs of a CIA agent.
Excuse me. John Malkovich calls him my memoir.
Okay, so a disc containing the memoir of a CIA agent ends up in the hands of two unscrupulous gym employees who attempt to sell it.
Which is Brad Pitt and Frances McDormand. Frances McDormand wants money for cosmetic surgeries. Brad Pitt's an idiot. He's just an idiot. He's an idiot. As a matter of fact, speaking of how he's an idiot, Pitt said of the role, quote, "After reading the part, which they said was handwritten for myself, I was not sure if I should be flattered or insulted."
Yeah, seriously.
Pitt also said when he was shown the script, he told the Coens he did not know how to play the part because the character was such an idiot. There was a pause, and then Joel goes, "You'll be fine."
So like I said, do they have faith in his acting potential, or do they really think he's an idiot?
We'll never know. We'll never know. According to the costume designer, she said even cheap suits look good on Brad Pitt. So for the scene where his character Chad wears a cheap suit, she had to tailor a suit with a purposefully bad and ill-fitting cut and a hard-looking wool tie. They had to go out of their way to make him look bad in
the
suit.
Because apparently the suit looks better because Brad Pitt's in it, not the other way around.
It's Brad Pitt, man.
Not because Brad Pitt doesn't look better because he's wearing the suit. The suit looks better because Brad Pitt is in it.
It's like how I told you, you know, if you're in a room by yourself, you're just Drew. Yeah. It's like, yeah, who cares? Brad Pitt comes in the room. You're in the same room as Brad Pitt. Now you're Drew. Because you're that close to Brad Pitt.
No, I am not Drew. Now I'm even less Drew because why? That's fucking Brad Pitt.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all about perspective. Drew Sircogburn. Opening weekend made $19 million. It was a comedy starring George Clooney and Brad Pitt. How could it not make some coin, right?
Yeah.
It grossed $60 million in the U.S. and Canada, $100 million in other countries, $161 million overall. Made some money there.
Mm-hmm.
Good for them. And now they're like, you know what? Let's go back to the arty weirdness. And do A Serious Man, 2009, A Serious Man. Fuck George Clooney and Brad Pitt,
probably
all these movie stars.
Their Jewiest movie to date.
They're only one that even, because they are Jewish, and they grew up in a Jewish family, Jewish family, and it's their only movie that
even
directly addresses Judaism, Jewish life, Jewish family life. They said that, you know, their previous movies have probably been informed by their Jewish upbringing. I mean, how could it not be?
Yeah.
But this is the first time they're like, you know what? Because they were making a movie in part about where they grew up, 1950s suburbs, Minnesota. A Jewish family in 1950s suburbs, Minnesota, which is a weird fucking thing.
IMDb says Larry Gopnik, a Midwestern physics teacher, watches his life unravel over multiple sudden incidents.
Yeah.
Though seeking meaning and answers amidst his turmoils, he seems to keep sinking.
Yeah. It's Jope.
It is.
He's Jope. His life just gets worse and worse. His wife leaves him for a pillar of the Jewish community, the local community, so he looks like a real shitbag. His brother is going down the tubes, Richard Kind. his kids are, you know, they're at that teenage stage where they hate their parents and they're doing their own crazy things. One of them is trying to save money for a nose job. The other one just cares about F Troop. It's all going horrible. Student tries blackmailing them.
Yep.
No, yeah, student tries blackmailing them. First tries to pay him off. Then they try blackmailing him. And then he's got this the Columbia Records record company. They keep trying to get him to pay for Santana's Abraxas. He's like, I don't want Santana's Abraxas. I didn't ask for Santana's Abraxas. It's going horrible for the guy. And in the beginning of the movie, they talk about, was it Schrodinger's cat?
Yeah.
The cat in the box.
Yes.
You put poison in the box. Is the cat dead or alive? We don't know. Not until we open the box.
Nope.
So because we don't know, the cat is both
alive
and dead. The whole movie is like that. It's like, why are these things happening? Is this happening for a reason? Is this real? Is it not real? But we don't know. So is it both?
I mean, he even goes to his rabbi and asks those specific questions.
He gets specifically asks questions, and then he gets a bunch of bullshit answers.
Yeah. Go figure. You ask questions, you get bullshit answers from religious folks.
Yeah, so what does that say about what the Coens think about religion and all that stuff? Now, the Coens themselves stated that the, quote, germ of the story was a rabbi from their adolescence, a mysterious figure who had a private conversation with each student at the conclusion of their religious education. Joel Coen said that it seemed appropriate to open the film with a Yiddish folktale, but as the brothers didn't know any suitable ones, they wrote their own.
Nice.
Just very Coens, right? And that the opening scene was nothing more than a little short that they made up to get the audience in a proper mood, and that there's no real meaning behind it, which is hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Serious Man, it got a bunch of critical acclaim, didn't make much money. As a matter of fact, I don't even have that here. It only cost them $7 million to make it, and it grossed $31 total. So they knew that it wasn't going to make that much money. They made it for super cheap. Majority of the film's awards and nominations were in the categories of screenplay, best picture, cast, and cinematography. The Coens were awarded best original screenplay by the National Board of Review. It's one of those ones where everyone loved it, but no one saw it. As a matter of fact, the BBC News, well, it was nominated for Best Picture, 82nd Academy Awards. BBC News called it, quote, one of the less talked about nominees.
Ah, yes.
And then again, like I was saying, fuck George Clooney and Brad Pitt and, you know, movie stars. They got Michael Stuhlbarg to play the lead, who at that time was a Broadway star. And since then, still a Broadway star.
Good for him.
Yeah. Good for him. Good for you. Good for you. Two movies left. Going back to the remakes. Half remake, half book adaptation.
All My Namesake.
All Your Namesake. We're talking about The Tale of Drewster Cogburn, True Grit. 2010's True Grit. Absolutely. Starring Jeff Bridges as
Rooster Cogburn.
Yes. It was nominated at the Academy Awards for Best Actor for Jeff Bridges, Adapted Screenplay for the Coens, Art Direction, Cinematography for Roger Deakins, who comes back, Costume Design, Best Director, Best Picture, Editing, Sound Mixing, Supporting Actress for Haley Seinfeld, the 13-year-old girl. And it won exactly none of those awards.
Bagel.
Not a one of them. Big old delicious bagel with cream cheese on it. Because it's fine, because who cares about winning awards or even being nominated? It's a good movie.
Yes,
it's a damn good movie.
It is.
Their first straight-up Western.
Yeah.
Right? No Country for Old Men.
It was Western-ish.
Western-ish. A simple, Blood Simple, which was set in West Texas. Western. This is their first time. Like, these guys are on horses.
Yeah.
We're shooting six shooters. You know, this is a fucking Western.
Yeah. There are cowboy hats and eye patches and all sorts of fun
stuff.
The
whole 9 yards. The whole 10 yards. The whole 13 yards. I don't have a budget, but I do have a grand total of $250 million worldwide for this movie.
Ching.
That's a fucking moneymaker. There's no way that movie costs that much money. Even with the cast, with Jeff Bridges and Matt Damon. Josh Brolin having to pay for, all the set design. Because if you're making a Western, you have to provide everything. You know, that's a lot of work. Could not have cost more than $50 million, $60 million. Yeah. No way. And 250 worldwide. God damn, that's just box office.
Yep,
got all that that DVD money too, and the streaming money and the Redbox money and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then now it seems like at this point they're almost doing a one for them, one for me, right? Because they got a Burn After Reading makes a ton of money. Serious Man, this one's for us. Mm-hmm. True Grit,
bunch of money,
ton of money,
and
then followed up with Inside Llewyn Davis, 2013.
One for
Inside
them.
Llewyn Davis. So definitely a one for them. Although, again, like a Serious Man, small budget, only $11 million to make it, $32 million worldwide.
But it's got your boy in it.
It's got my boy. It's got Oscar Isaac, who at this point, Oscar Isaac, he was just in Sucker Punch a couple years before that.
Drive.
Drive in 2011. And I think his most recent thing before Llewyn Davis was The Bourne. What's the one with Jeremy Renner? The Bourne Legosi.
Yes.
The Bourne Legosi is the Jason Bourne movie I want to see about a vampire. With Bela Lugosi.
Okay.
The Bourne Legosi. The Bourne Legacy. Yeah, he's in that. He's got one, two scenes. And then they hit him with the missile and he dies.
Yes.
It's like, Oscar Isaac, you're just going to kill him?
Yep.
Anyway. But now he's about to be the biggest guy in the fucking world with you got the Star Wars and X-Men coming out.
Yeah.
Come on. He's going to be, won't even be able to get in the same room as that guy. But they got him for Inside Llewyn Davis. He played the role. Part of the reason why he got the lead is because he could play guitar. Mm-hmm. He's already a bit of an accomplished guitar player and a decent enough singer,
yeah.
Which actually, he is just a good enough singer that's almost perfect for the role.
Yeah, because they just need to be good enough.
Just good enough, right? Yeah. Good enough that he gets gigs, people like him. But like they say in the movie, like, yeah, you know what? You need a partner. You need to work with someone, yeah. And then you two can elevate each other. Inside Llewyn Davis, a movie about an artist struggling with their art, you know, on a meta level, on the existential level, is what the movie is about. What it's really about is about the 1960s folk scene in New York City and the asshole singer who's couch surfing and trying to decide whether he's going to keep going on or whether he's going to pack it all in. And that's Oscar Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Loosely based on a book.
Yes.
The Mayor of McDougal Street. McDougal Street. The Mayor of McDougal Street, which is based on singer Dave Von Ronk. But then Llewyn Davis and Dave Von Ronk are still very, very different people. So that's why I say it's a very, very loose adaptation of that book there.
He's back with Carey Mulligan.
Yeah. Carey Mulligan, who is...
I mean, they were together in Drive.
Hey, Carey, how you doing? It won the Grand Prix at the 2013 Cannes Film Festival. It was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. Again, Best Cinematography, Mr. Deakins, and Best Sound Mixing. And Joe Cohen once said, quote, "The film doesn't really have a plot. That concerned us at one point. That's why we threw the cat in."
Ah, yes, the cat. Yeah. So I guess that's a plot point.
Because it is a rambling, shambling movie. Like, he's trying to get work. And first, he's like with the girl, and she's like, "I'm pregnant." He's like, "Shit, and I got to pay for your abortion." And then he's like, "Oh, okay, I'm making money this way." It's very episodic. And
then there's this cat. Then I lose it. Then I find something else.
And that's like the kind of a one thread through the whole thing, where the cat keeps coming up over and over and over again. Another one where the soundtrack is fantastic. I like an Ordinary Brothers soundtrack, actually, because they took the same approach. They even got T-Bone Burnett to do the same thing. He curated the bluegrass music for Old Brother, and then he curated a lot of the folk stuff for Llewyn Davis. And that was their most latest film. They've announced what they're doing next. It's a movie called Hail Caesar with an exclamation point in the title. George Clooney, like I said, he's coming back. He's playing another idiot. This movie is about 1950s Hollywood. It's probably one of their screwball comedies because it's about a fixer, a Hollywood fixer.
Okay.
One of those things. Think,
gotcha.
Think The Wolf.
Yeah.
But in a Coen Brothers movie set in the 50s.
And he's an idiot.
And he's an idiot. Well, is the fixer the idiot, or is he fixing up idiot's problems?
No. The fixer's got to be the idiot.
We'll see. All right, that'll be an interesting movie. A dumb fixer.
That's what I'm saying.
Never seen that in a movie. Now, I was asking online today, trying to get an informal, though highly scientific poll, favorite Coen Brothers movies. Before I say what they are, give me your three.
What would be your three?
In no particular order.
Doesn't have to be in any order.
I'm going
to
go...
They're not weighted here.
Miller's Crossing.
Uh-huh.
No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
And today we're going to go with Raising Arizona.
Sure, okay, that's fine. Yeah.
I got that on a daily basis, though.
I got that a bunch of times, though. I got that. People said, if you ask me now, it's these three movies. But if you ask me in the future, it could change. And
yeah,
I understand that.
I mean, Miller's Crossing and No Country are definitely the two that got me.
Raising, No Country, and Miller's Crossing. My three would actually be Barton Fink,
mm-hmm.
Miller's Crossing,
mm-hmm.
and Blood Simple.
Mm.
Yes. So I actually, when I thought about it, I found it a little surprising that I love all their movies. I love them all. And Inside Llewyn Davis kind of got consideration there for top three because I just love the subject matter. But I was surprised that three of my favorites were three of their earliest.
Yeah.
You know. But I do. Those are movies I love. Now, on Facebook, I want to bring this up. Our homeboy, Billy D. First to respond, which I appreciate, Billy. And I just had a year and it took me away. Oh, shit. We got a late entry into the poll. Oh, where'd he go? Nope. Never mind. I thought it was there. Oh, no. You just liked it. Well, see, if I ask you a question, what are your three favorite Coen Brothers movies? Why would you like it, but then not answer it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, Billy writes, he said Raising Arizona, Fargo, No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. Call this the Big Lebowski Memorial List, since everyone will say the Big Lebowski is their favorite, even me most days. Which and then the very next person, Chris from Chris Ellis from Forget That Yo says, Raising Arizona, Big Lebowski, no brother. Yeah. Very next one. But no, I mean, anyone can say, I'm fine with people saying Big Lebowski, but I was thinking when he said that, that Big Lebowski isn't their most popular movie. I would say their most popular movies are the ones that got the most, that made the most money and got the most award consideration, and that would be Fargo and No Country. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I just thought about my dad. My dad, not in the, he watches movies, but he's not a movie buff or anything. He just watches them, like, just whatever. It's just entertainment. Loves, loves, loves Fargo.
Yeah.
Loves it. Does not get into Big Lebowski. Watch it. It's like, this movie stinks. I don't like it. No, but he loves Fargo. That's why I figured. And my hugely scientific research here bears that out, I gotta say.
There we go.
Fargo had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 mentions, votes, however you want to say, between Facebook and Twitter. No Country for Old Men, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, including yours.
Yeah.
Okay. Big Lebowski was in third, though. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 for Big Lebowski. Come up right behind that, Raising Arizona. Mm-hmm. Interesting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. For Raising Arizona. Now the rest of them, much less. We got three for Burn After Reading, three for Millet's Crossing, and two of those are from you and me. Yeah. So think about
what does that say about us?
What does that say about us? Blood Simple only got two. One of those is mine. Oh Brother Where Art Thou, two. Barton Fink, three.
One of them is yours.
One of those is mine. Only getting one mentioned each. True Grit, Inside Llewyn Davis, A Serious Man, Hudsucker Proxy, The Lady Killers, which I found surprising. Only one not to be mentioned at all, Intolerable Cruelty.
That's because it's the worst one.
It's because it doesn't cause it. Kind of stinks.
Yeah.
Although, I'd have to rewatch them back to back. It's possible Lady Killers is worse.
If you say so, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it might, at that point, though, it might be like 1A and 1B. Nah, I'm saying. So, there you go. Fargo, No Country, those are the movies that people really think about. And then Big Lebowski are the three that people think about first when they think of No Country. But this bears also that there's something for everyone, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And no one is interested in a Coen's rom-com.
Nope.
Even if it has
nope.
Catherine Zeta-Jones and George Clooney. So, yeah, there you go. Those are the Coens. Them's awesome. The Coen brothers and all their movies. They got a lot of goddamn movies. And we even talk about the ones that they only produced or they wrote or they co-wrote because they have a bunch of those too.
That was a long fucking episode, Chris.
Oh, man, look at that. So thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it. And thank you, Drew.
You're welcome.
We'll be back this weekend with episode 116 of Cinema Crespediso with special guest, the Black Castle of Anthony Davis from Forget That Yo Radio. It's going to be a lot of fun. And there you go. So thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Go watch a Coen Brothers movie, support R-rated films, and read more books.